Welcome back to the Indie Vets Happy Hour. I am your host, Dr. Andrew Heller, DVM. And as usual, I'm with my co-host, Dr. Marissa Brunetti.
VMD.
VMD.
Good to see you, Andrew.
Great to see you, Marissa. A lot been going on.
So much. You're on the road?
I'm traveling everywhere. I was in Austin. I've been in Miami. I've been in New York City. And this weekend, I'll be at the Fetch conference in Charlotte. So nice. By the time people are listening to this, it will have already been. And hopefully I have met you there, if you were.
If you are a veterinarian, please find Andrew.
I really enjoyed meeting you. I'm just going to tell you right now. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Andrew does enjoy meeting veterinarians, a lot of them. So
I do.
So yeah, so we're recording before you jet off to Charlotte and finishing out, one of our last topics in endocrinology, we're going to talk about feline pancreatitis, which I hate, and that's probably going to be the title of this episode. So, Andrew, what's the goal of this episode, and who is the episode intended for?
So, we're going to discuss pancreatitis in cats. Yes, thanks for that. And if you do want to catch our episode on pancreatitis in dogs, it was two episodes ago, so it was episode 29. The goal of this is to talk about the disease process in cats and note some of the differences that, you know, exist between the feline and the canine version of this disease, go through, you know, why it's important, what does the disease look like, when should it be on your differential list, potential causes, how to diagnose it, how to treat it, and of course, prognosis. So I want to go through all of that stuff, and hopefully some general practitioners out there are listening, some technicians are listening, practice managers, owners. It's really for everyone who's interested in this stuff, because it is interesting. Endocrinology is one of our favorite topics.
Well, mostly because it's very common in veterinary medicine. So, all right. So in cats, you know, this disease is relatively common. Do you want to briefly talk about the types of pancreatitis, high level, since, you know, most of the time in GP, we're not biopsying the pancreas and figuring out exactly what this may be, but tell us the different types.
Well, I think the most common type that we'll come across, we may not have diagnosed it, but we'll definitely come across this chronic non-suppurative pancreatitis. It's really different from, you know, a dog pancreatitis, and we talked about that, where it's characterized by a lymphocytic plasmacytic infiltration. And there's fibrosis of the pancreas, the acinar cells atrophy. And, you know, this actually may result in other diseases like diabetes mellitus in cats and exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, less common, but certainly other diseases of the pancreas. So that's going to be the most common. And then, of course, there's the acute version. There's the acute necrotizing version, the acute necrotizing pancreatitis. That's going to be your most common acute pancreatitis, I should say. And it's not really seen like it is in dogs. So it's not, you're not going to have like really overweight cats eating, you know, high fat diets. This is typically more like underweight cats. And it's characterized by a glandular and peripancreatic fat necrosis. And then, of course, the other version is the acute suppurative pancreatitis, where you have actual neutrophilic infiltration into the pancreas.
Yes. And my favorite, acute on chronic.
Yes.
I remember being in vet school and they would talk about acute on chronic, and I was like, what? Doesn't it then just become acute?
Yeah.
But anyway, you can't get acute flare-ups on cats that have chronic pancreatitis too. So that may be something you see.
And you know, just going back to the chronic pancreatitis, what's really interesting when I was researching some of this, up to 45% of clinically normal cats at the time of death, when they did a necropsy, 45% had histologic evidence of pancreatitis. So it's a lot more common than we even know or see. I remember learning about that, but I didn't realize it was such a high number.
Yeah. And once again, cats are very good at hiding disease processes and pain. So for pet owners out there, you know, noting if your cat is hiding more or not doing their normal activities, this may just be a sign of pain and they should see their veterinarian.
And put it on your differential list for sure.
Absolutely. So what causes pancreatitis? And don't say we don't know.
All right. I won't say we don't know. How about it's typically unknown?
Okay. All right. Typically idiopathic.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's been associated with so many different concurrent issues, obviously trauma, just like with dogs, you know, if you traumatize the pancreas, it's been associated. Other things that cats typically present with, like toxoplasmosis, pancreatic fluke infections, anesthesia.
Never seen FIP, that.
Yeah, FIP, Khaleesi virus, organophosphate toxicity. I will just throw that one on there as, you know, potential toxin. But typically, you know, we see concurrent diseases in addition to those things. So cats often will have IBD or even bioiditis or triaditis, where the pancreas, the liver, and the small intestine are affected. And some studies have shown up to 50% of cats that have pancreatitis also have liver and small intestinal inflammation as well.
Yeah.
Chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury, you know, up to about a third of cases have concurrent disease in that form. Diabetes mellitus, we mentioned, about 13% from one study we saw. Hepatic lipidosis, we've talked about GI disease and cholangitis and cholangiohepatitis. I'd say that's the list of concurrent diseases that we see associated with pancreatitis in cats.
Yes, cats like to get triaditis. So if you think it's just pancreatitis, you're likely mistaken half of the time.
And if you think it's just IBD, put pancreatitis on there as well.
Which can make these cases difficult to treat in the long run.
Yeah.
Also something that I found for risk factors. So I know you went over some infections, toxo, parvo, Khaleesi, herpes, corona, cat corona, not human corona. I also found in today's veterinary practice, some specialists were saying hypercalcemia could be a risk factor. And as we all know, cats can get idiopathic hypercalcemia, which is frustrating because sometimes you never find an answer. But if you do have a patient with that, you know, just keep pancreatitis in the back of your mind just in case they may have some like very, very waxing and waning signs or just vague signs I would keep in mind.
You know, back to differences about cats and dogs, one thing I noticed was that because of the anatomy of a cat, of their biliary outflow and pancreatic duct being combined in a cat, they're more likely to have an actual bacterial pancreatitis than dogs.
The bacteria can like retrograde back up into the pancreas. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So as you know, I don't like to spend too much time on this because we all know most of this, but what is this going to look like from an owner's perspective and also from a vet's perspective when we examine these cats?
Yeah, I think people are going to just notice an increase in lethargy, likely anorexia, so not eating as much, weight loss. And, you know, a vet might actually on PE feel an abdominal mass in the cranial abdomen. A big difference between dogs and cats is the vomiting. So in dogs, we see a lot of vomiting. In cats, we don't see that as often. And one study showed only 35% of cats with chronic pancreatitis vomit.
I didn't know it was that little.
Yeah.
And obviously with the acute, terrible signs of pancreatitis, you're going to see very more severe signs, possibly shock, possibly icterus, and
certainly dehydration.
Absolutely. So there's very nonspecific signs that you can see on serum, chem, and CBC. Can you go through those real quick?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're unlikely to see much of a change in a CBC, but you may see anemia or you may see a hemoconcentrated sample. And that's obviously due to dehydration. I found it interesting that you may see leukopenia or you may see leukocytosis. So just right. Abnormalities in general are possible, but again, not specific. Once you get to the chem profile, that's where it becomes a little bit easier.
Well, you're basically kind of looking for severity at this point, right? If you see a ton of changes in the liver values or electrolytes, things like that, you may be pointed, you know, to maybe this cat needs to be hospitalized versus like you may not see any abnormalities on the biochem.
And when we get to the treatments, that's when that comes into play, really just kind of bringing them back to homeostasis.
Yeah. And what are the two things that we shouldn't use to diagnose pancreatitis in cats on the chem screen?
Amylase and lipase, just like with dogs, we don't really use that. It's not reliable at all.
All right, and then obviously, you know, you can see changes in your UA or your coag profile, depending on how severe this is as well. And then there are two additional tests that look at pancreatic enzymes. One that you may see, but we don't use to diagnose pancreatitis in cats is the TLI, so the feline trypsin-like immunoreactivity test. It has low sensitivity and specificity pretty much. So if it's elevated at all, it's an early acute pancreatitis, but it can be normal in some cats with acute pancreatitis. So don't use the TLI for pancreatitis diagnosis in cats. And I would skip that, of course, and I would use the PLI, which is much more available these days. And I know we briefly talked about this in dogs, but there is a SNAP PLI, which is not quantitative, but then there is the SPECT FPL, which will give you a quantity, right? A number. So you can actually see, you know, how high it is.
And so if you have a SNAP, you should follow it by a SPECT, right?
Yeah. Although if you can only get the owner to do one, the SNAP is probably cheaper if there's financial concerns and you could at least see if it was abnormal.
But not every practice will have them.
Correct. Yeah. I was going to say, like I said before, I don't see that many since people can easily get the SPECT now. And in a lot of profiles, like even wellness panels, they're putting a SPECT PL in there. So
that's
great. Sometimes, yeah, I mean, it's great or also not great. It's tough because then, I mean, you do have to go down a little bit of a rabbit hole. But I think for these cats that you see only once a year, right, and you convince the owner to do blood work, which you should every year in your cat, maybe you can be pointed to maybe that's why the cat has lost half a pound and everything else is normal. So
the good thing is it's pretty specific, though, the spec. Yeah. So if it's normal, it's likely that they're healthy.
Yep.
Absolutely. Like close to 100%, I believe.
Yeah. So there are obviously other diagnostics that you can do. We always talk about x-rays, but you typically can't see the pancreas on radiographs, even if it is severe. So I would save my money from that and I would go to an ultrasound.
I mean, unless you have other things on your differential list that you're trying to rule out. But
sure, like obstruction, which is basically what I would be looking for in a cat. But yeah, so ultrasonography, much better at diagnosing pancreatitis than radiography, but the changes may be subtle. And if you're not an experienced radiologist, it can be hard to not only find the pancreas, but determine if it's abnormal. So the way it looks with acute pancreatitis is that it may be enlarged and hypoechoic compared with a hyperechoic pancreas in chronic cases. So what are some definitive diagnoses?
So, I mean, I don't know when I would do this unless I needed to. So this would be less common, but I think that the only way to definitively diagnose pancreatitis is to get an actual biopsy.
Sure. Yeah. Histopath.
And, you know, that's not common. It's not commonly done.
My guess is like maybe you're in the abdomen for something else and you see the pancreas and you're like, ooh, that doesn't look right. So you biopsy it. I have seen some pancreatic cytologies. I don't think I've diagnosed it via histopath ever in my career, but of course, gold standard.
And we know that like trauma can trigger pancreatitis. So like messing around with the pancreas when you're not, you know, when you don't need to, I would avoid.
Yeah. Yes. Like we talked about with dogs.
Yeah. Like ultrasound guided FNAs of the pancreas. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable doing that unless I needed to for some reason.
Well, I think the good news is you can also like you could culture that if you're trying to rule out infectious disease, because that's a very good transition into how do we treat this disease process in cats.
Because the signs are all over the place, I think in the end, we really just need to focus on supportive care. And what that means is addressing the nausea. The nausea leads to anorexia. So we need to address that potentially with diet, likely with diet. We need to address the pain that they go through. We all know pancreatitis is painful. And the dehydration, of course.
Some things that I think are interesting, and we are getting away from this as a profession, but always throwing like Pepcid or gastroprotectant at cats and dogs when we're giving them Sirenia. And we've found, and studies have shown recently, that that's not helpful and can sometimes be deleterious. So gastrointestinal protectants are not, if ever, indicated unless you have found something different in the stomach. But if you do use them, they can actually upset the microbiota of your gut and actually cause more issues. So I thought that was interesting to think about. And then also, you know, other things that are contraindicated would be NSAIDs, of course, NSAIDs and GI protectants.
So fluids, We're talking about antiemetics like Sirenia, appetite stimulants like mirtazapine, pain meds like buprenorphine, right, mm-hmm. in cats, and then potentially some antioxidants like SAMe.
Yeah, and I also saw, and I've never used this, but it makes sense, especially if you have triaditis or something else, but using ursodiol because of its anti-inflammatory properties. Oh, so
that's interesting.
Yeah. So let's talk about something really confusing, which is diet.
Yeah, and I also want to get back to antibiotics, too.
Oh, yes. Also contraindicated unless you have proven there is a, you know, microbial issue. Although, you know, I did read that, you know, sometimes if this is immune mediated and you're, you know, using steroids, some people say, like, if you can't prove there's no bacteria, should you use empirical antibiotics if you're going to use steroids? And I think most people would say yes.
Mm. Good to know.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's get back to diets then. So in a dog, we want to use a low fat diet. In a cat, because that dietary cause is really non-existent, like it is in dogs, what do we want to use in cats?
Well, I mean, high protein, low carb, which is a good cat diet anyway.
Yeah.
For them, you know, but the biggest point is obviously to take into account concurrent conditions. So like a lot of these cats may have, you know, hepatic lipidosis or IBD and need very special diets. So like hepatic lipidosis, you're going to have really high protein, 30 to 40% of metabolized energy. And then if you have IBD, should you have a novel or a hydrolyzed protein diet? All these things need to be taken into consideration. But there is no like perfect diet for a cat with chronic pancreatitis.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. So treating other diseases and making sure the diets match that disease state as well. Like you said, yeah. IBD, if they're diabetic, of course, mm-hmm. then you know you need to make sure that's likely prioritized.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, high protein, low carb, right? That's like a diabetic diet for cats. So, all right. So what are some important things to tell your clients, you know, during diagnosis, treatment, and then after about, you know, their cats with pancreatitis?
It's likely that this disease process is going to recur. And I think owners need to understand that, you know, this is likely going to be a lifelong issue that they're going to need to be on alert for. And so we have to be really good about managing diet, you know, really paying attention to your cats, you know, especially if they're like indoor, outdoor, really trying to monitor their ins and outs really effectively, making sure that they have a lot of access to water and monitoring their water intake. I think just monitoring your pets is just really important, especially once they have a chronic issue like this.
And obviously managing risk factors, right? So if there's lots of cars right outside your house, you know, don't let your cat go outside and get traumatized. Make sure they're on a very good dewormer. I'm going to recommend Heartworm. I'm going to recommend Revolution Plus every month for all cats, whether they're indoor or outdoor. Managing infections appropriately. Making sure they're not on any unnecessary drugs, since a lot of drugs can be a risk factor. I think cats are tough. They are very, very special unicorns. And so sometimes you don't know what's going on with them, but look at your cats. So what's the prognosis for cats with this disease?
Well, if it's mild, it's excellent. I mean, if you treat the symptoms, they're going to get through it. Like I said before, though, it may recur. If it's severe, you know, if we're talking about what we talk, if you go back to our dog discussion where we talk about more severe types of pancreatitis, you know, if you see that in the cat, meaning, you know, coagulation issues and kidney injury, the prognosis is going to be poor.
And then one thing that I didn't mention that I had read elsewhere, just as a tidbit, most of us think, oh, the cat's clinically normal, it goes on with its life, etc., after we treat it. But, you know, ideally, I mean, if this is chronic and this is an issue, the spec FPL should be rechecked, usually in about 2 to 3 weeks until it plateaus. So it may not actually ever go back to normal in these cats. But if they're clinically doing well and everything else looks great, then you can stop monitoring.
Well, great. So for anybody that was zoned out for this entire podcast, let's just sort of summarize all of it. So pancreatitis in cats, there's a lack of specific clinical signs. It's mainly a chronic disease in cats. It's relatively difficult to diagnose definitively in both dogs and cats, but we're talking about cats now. even harder in cats. The treatment is mainly symptomatic and supportive, as it is in dogs. And lots of cats get it idiopathically, meaning we don't know the cause. And so it often goes undetected and undiagnosed.
And lastly, as you just said, its management is nonspecific and multifaceted. And like we talked about, you know, you want to manage risk factors and nutrition. You want to deliver supportive care. You want to diagnose, this is important, and manage concurrent conditions. And something we didn't talk a lot about, but is worth looking up, sometimes this is immune mediated and sometimes steroids are indicated. So just keep that in the back of your mind and monitor the FPL if this is a chronic case and you have concerns.
Great. Great summary. Thank you.
No, thank you, Andrew. It's always a pleasure.
Thank everybody for listening and joining us today.
We hope you enjoyed this episode on the Indie Vets Happy Hour. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. And if you like us, leave us a 5-star review and make sure to subscribe so you can be alerted whenever we have a new episode. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at clinical@indievets.com. Also, to learn more about us and how we're making vet med better, head to indievets.com. That's INDEVETS.com. While you're there, be sure to head to our blog for the latest stories and tips from our doctors. And lastly, if you're interested in joining our amazing Indie Vets team, please email Dr. Andrew Heller at andrew@indievets.com. See you next time. Cheers. Cheers.
I'm a veterinarian, sure, but I'm way more than that. I'm also a tango dancer, a struggling but determined pie maker, and a mom. With Indie Vets, I get to choose when and where I work. I create my own schedule and choose shifts at nearby animal hospitals that are right for me. Having that flexibility is exactly what I need to have plenty of time for all those other things that I am. Because I'm more than just a vet. Visit IndieVets.com to learn more and apply.